Hello and welcome to the Roy Harper podcast. This is episode number 32, published in March 2011.
Open your eyes, ingratiate, don't scupper. Open your eyes, I'm the great Roy Harper.
So I guess the first thing to say is Happy New Year, since we haven't had a podcast out in this year yet. Hope you all had a really good Christmas holiday, New Year. It seems such a long time ago now. Anyway, moving swiftly on, we have plenty to talk about this month. We have the usual news section. We have an interview with Tobin from Norway and a selection of music. And we'll kick off straight away with the news section. Now, I doubt that there'll be many Harper fans that aren't aware that there is actually a Roy Harper gig in April. That's actually in a week's time as I record this, because I've been a bit tardy getting this out. And it's a special gig. It's a filmed TV concert as part of the ITV Legends series. And I'll read you what's on the website. Roy Harper has a pedigree of no less than 14 live and 21 studio albums, and is credited as friend, inspiration and mentor to many of today's great artists. From being guest vocalist to Pink Floyd, Have a Cigar, to the subject of a Led Zeppelin song, Hats Off to Harper, to receiving the Mojo Hero Award from Jimmy Page, Roy's career has never known a dull moment. His appearances are rare. Two Festival Hall in the last 18 months. That's not quite right, but never mind. Roy will join us to be filmed in front of an audience of just 125 guests on Saturday, April the 2nd. After a champagne reception, there will be two 45-minute sets spanning much of his career. You will meet Roy after the concert, and your name will be on the DVD and credit roll of the programme. Photographs taken at the concert and receptions will be available to all attendees, and you can have all this for the knockdown price of £195. Now, this news came out a couple of months ago now, I suppose, and it was caused some division, shall we say, amongst Harper fans because of the price of the concert. Now, Van de Graaff Generator, which long-time listeners will know are one of my favourite other bands, did one of these in December of last year, and I've been reading some accounts of the concert, and it was apparently a fantastic experience, complete success, very much worth the money. Everybody was happy, and I believe the DVD of that's coming out in a few weeks' time. And I'm very pleased that Roy's been invited on to do the same thing. Now, obviously, it's very expensive, but it's a limited attendance gig. It's a special one-off thing, really, and lots of champagne to drink, obviously. So I'm going. You knew I was going to say that, didn't you? I'm going next weekend, and I shall be meeting up with some old friends, including Mr. Darren Crisp, who also is going and staying in the same hotel as me. So I'm hoping for some rekindling of old friendships. It's going to be an exciting day. And I will be putting a podcast out fairly soon after the gig with some ideas and impressions of how it went. I will take my portable microphone. I'm certainly not going to try and record the gig, but I might have a few sound bites with people before or after, or both. We'll see how it goes and how much champagne gets drunk. So that's something to really look forward to. Now, those of you that were too late to buy a ticket or just can't afford to, and let's face it, we're going through pretty tough times at the moment. Not everybody can afford £195 at the drop of a hat. There's indications that there will be a special event later this year, Roy's 70th birthday and all that kind of stuff. Tracy's hinted at it through various social networks, but we don't have any fixed strong details yet. So I'm going to see what I can find out next weekend, and hopefully I'll have some more news for you on the next podcast. Okay, in other news, Nick Harper is busy gigging, and you can obviously find out his tour dates from his website. But there's one particular thing I want to draw attention to, which is that he's playing a festival gig at a thing called the Soul Party, the Summer of Love Party. Now, I'm going to this. It's in July. Nick's actually on the 15th of July on the Friday night. And basically, it's like a private party. There's only a couple of hundred people going to be there. It's held at a private residence in Kent. It's not really a festival, and it's certainly not commercially run. But it's being organised by a couple of people that I know, one of whom, John Cholmondeley, who was the person that interviewed Nigel Maslin-Jones a few episodes back, if you remember. He's an all-round good guy. I'm really looking forward to going and meeting up with John. So I think for those of you that don't mind a bit of festival experience but don't want anything too big and cumbersome, this might be something worth looking at. www.soulparty.org.uk, and of course I'll put the link to that in the show notes as well. So that's another thing to look at. Okay, that's it for the news section. I'm now going to play a track by Adam Leonard. Now, Adam did the intro music, which I've just played for you, the great Roy Harper, and has been forging a very interesting solo career in the last few years. And he's taken the most agreeable step of issuing a live album for free download. The album is called To Give Up, You Have to Bloody Start, and I've listened to it a few times. I really, really like it. So I asked Adam if it would be okay to play a track on the podcast, because I know that a number of people are interested in where the title track came from, and I thought you might be interested in what Adam does with his own songs. Now, since I actually did that, Adam's also put his first studio album up for free download as well, which is called How Music Sounds. So if you like the sound of this, go to Adam's main website on themessagetapes.com, and from there you can go onto the download site, adamleonard.bandcamp.com, and again, you know, I'll put all of this in the show notes, but this is a track called Deep Sea Diver. Thanks a lot, Adam. I think that's fantastic. What a great guitar sound. Really good finger picking. Lovely voice. You've got it all going, mate. I really hope you do well with all this. It's really good. Okay, just before the interview, we'll have one more track. And this is Roy. And the track is Love Me. And it's from Poems, Speeches, Thoughts and Doodles. Thank you.
yours forever. Love me. All I want is you. Winter storms alarm, spring dawns in your arms. Come a day, come along, summer day. Love me. Lead me. Tell me how you want me to love you. Lead me. Tell me how you want it done. I'll do it for you with a touch or two. Anything you wanna do, coming true. Come a day, come along, summer day. Lead me to the woman in your passion. Lead me to you, lead me to you, lead me to love. I don't wanna spend another day without you, babe. Without you, love me. Leave me, and I'll leave your dreams forever. Leave me. Black hole of your life. I wake you with a taste for another day. A beautiful way, love astray. Come a day, come along, summer day. Lead me to the woman in your passion. To you, lead me to you, lead me to love. I don't want to spend another day without you, babe.
This month, or I should say this podcast, since we're not quite monthly anymore, I have a fellow on the line called Tobin. He'll tell us what his proper full name is in a sec, and he's calling from Norway. Hi, Tobin.
Hello, good evening, Paul.
Hi there. Now, how do you pronounce your proper name?
Yeah, that's going to be a challenge, isn't it? It's Thorbjørn. Well, it's actually Norwegian. You call it Thorbjørn, but to vamp it up into proper English or to something that's, you know, maybe possible to understand, it would be Thorbjørn.
Thorbjørn.
Yes, and it's actually, if you divide it, it's Thor, like in the god, and it's Bjorn, like in Bjorn Borg, together.
Okay. So. Yeah, I can cope with that, although I think Tobin will do for me.
Well, Tobin will probably work out better in the long run, yeah.
So, Tobin, who are you? How did you How did you come across the podcast, and what tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, I'm in my early 40s. I'm actually in real estate and been in real estate for quite a number of years. And I really enjoy that. I'm working out of Oslo, where I also live. And I also I got into music quite early, and Roy Harper has popped up quite early in my awakening of what I like in music and so forth. So, what was the question again?
How did you come across the podcast?
The podcast, yeah. The podcast, stormcock.net. I was aware of the website, but not really the podcast until a month or so ago, where I discovered those. And it was on the internet. I've been aware of your site through Roy Harper's own website, through a link there, I think.
Oh, okay. So you've been overdosing on podcasts, have you, in the last few weeks?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been continuously on my every time I walk the dog or whatever. There's always a podcast from Paul Davison. Yeah.
You poor man.
No, it's great. It's marvelous. Absolutely. I have my compliments on the broadcast on the podcast. They're really great.
Well, Tobin emailed me a couple of weeks ago to say hello and said, oh, well, I'd be prepared to share my views from the Norwegian fans' point of view. And, of course, I jumped at the chance because I really like talking to Harper fans from everywhere. And, in fact, some of the interviews we've done with people outside of the UK have been really popular, the two mad beer-drinking Australians particularly. So I thought we could do the same sort of thing with you. But let's start at the beginning. You said you got into Harper fairly early. I'm always really keen to know how that comes about with people. Yeah. What age were you when you first started listening to music?
About 13 or 14, I suppose. I come from a well furnished home, so to speak. But but it was not really very musical. My parents weren't really all that interested, but I had an uncle who took more of an interest and introduced me to things like Dylan and Lennon and Toto and Billy Joel, different kinds of artists in the late 70s, early 80s were, well, high in the charts or in any way from his point of view interesting. So I got into music via my uncle. And then when I sort of broke out on my own, I discovered Bowie.
Oh, right.
So, yeah. And I'm a big Bowie fan, especially his albums from the 70s.
Yeah, me too.
And that was, at this point, vinyl was still, the basic, source of music. So I clearly remember going down to used record shops in Oslo and hunting down all the early 70s Bowie albums and so on. That's a really nice memory.
Bowie's a good place to start, actually. That's one of my early musical things, actually, because my sister was into Bowie when I was little. My sister's 5 or 6 years older than me. But for me, the Harper thing came via Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd, of course. How did you come across him?
Well, it's the usual route. Either it's the Zeppelin route or the Floyd route. That's my impression anyway. And we were also at that point into Led Zeppelin and also Pink Floyd. That came right after the Bowie thing. And I can't really remember. I clearly remember reading the sleeve notes for the Wish You Were Here album and noticing his name. And I suspect that was after listening to Wish You Were Here for quite a while and not really realizing that that song was sung by someone else, because in a weird way, his voice seems to me anyway like a curious blend of Gilmore and Waters together.
Yeah, it fits in, doesn't it?
Really, really good, really well. I suspect there are quite a lot of Pink Floyd fans out there that really hasn't, gotten aware of the fact that "Have a Cigar" is not it's sung by an outsider.
And of course, those were the days when we used to sit there listening to music with the album cover in our hands, poring over every last nuance of the artwork and the text.
Yeah, and also picking up all the different names from who did the production to who played what, and branching out on that. And that is how I got into Harper, because either it was the Hats Off to Roy Harper title, mm-hmm. or the fact that I read his name in the sleeve notes. Probably it was a combination of that made me stop when I was in the H section in a used record store in Oslo, and the HQ album popped up.
Right, so that was your first one.
Yeah, and I clearly remember standing there, you know, considering it, because I hadn't, you know, that was really, you know, striking out, because I didn't really hadn't heard anything of Roy Harper at that point except for Have a Cigar.
Yeah.
But I ended up buying it, and I also remember taking it home, and of course The Game was the first song that I heard.
Yeah.
And it just, that hit home.
It's a really good rocking album, that, and that is actually one of the ones that I play for people when they haven't heard him before, that, you know, that people that are less folky, shall we say, people that want a bit more rock, you know.
And I was all really impressed with the length of the song, the lyrics, the whole song. Of course, that's David Gilmour on the rhythm guitar also, isn't it?
Can't remember. Probably.
I think it is. And of course, spending with the solo. I also, you know, remember hoping that it was Gilmour doing the solo, because it's just a fantastic solo that is a really marvelous solo that Spedding plays on that song. At the end of there, it's fantastic.
Yeah. No, he's superb. Okay, so you obviously liked HQ enough to get some more.
Well, sometime after that, there was a notice in the paper in Oslo that saying Roy Harper was going to play the Sardines, which is at that point was a rather famous club in Oslo, in the vein of, or in similar to the 100 Club or something like that. You know, it's a dark cellar with a, you know, roof not too high. Mm-hmm. You got that club feeling.
Yeah.
And he was playing there, and of course, I wanted to go, and I did.
What year was that then?
This is the actual date was the 8th of February 1988.
Okay.
And when he got on stage, I think he was a little pressed for time, because he was probably going on from Oslo to another town, I think Stavanger, on the west side of the country, in the evening, and he had already probably gotten delayed by the flight or whatever. And when he got on stage, I think after playing one or two songs, he rather gruffly announced that this was the night that Harper didn't say anything.
Very rare.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, but I don't know about that. But I didn't quite catch the real significance of that until I saw him a couple of gigs later. But, yeah, that was a nice memory. Oh, it was the night Harper didn't say anything.
What sort of songs was he playing at that time? Because that was just before Once came out, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was right before The Senseless Myth.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah.
And I think he played, I remember, Pinches of Salt, which also is a personal favorite. I think it's a marvelous, I don't know what it's about, but it's a marvelous song. probably a couple of other songs also from Descendants, I think. But I can't remember anything else than that.
Right.
But I took some great pictures of him at that, and I'm going to, you know, we're going to follow up on that.
Oh, yes, you mentioned that in the emails, and I think everybody would be quite keen to see those.
Yeah.
That'd be really good. So what? So you bought one album and then saw him live, or did you have some other albums at that point?
No, I don't think. I think it was pretty close together, so I didn't buy an album because I think Descendants was released in June or later that year, and I also bought that. But in the meantime, I had gotten Bull in the Ming Ways, The Unknown Soldier, In Between Every Line, and the Juggle album also, I think.
Yeah, similar story to me, actually, because at that time, the early albums were pretty hard to get, particularly before CDs came out.
Yeah.
So you were doing the later stuff. I really like In Between Every Line as well, actually, as a live album. It's quite patchy, but it doesn't get talked about very much.
No, I think that also worked as a sort of an introduction to some of his older stuff, I think. So went back to, and I also have managed to find Valentine in all the original EMI issue or the EMI copies also. So that's a nice thing to have. I play vinyl, you know. I've gone back to vinyl, and I think that CD is gonna disappear, you know, sooner than soon.
Well, CD is disappearing. I still buy it. But I have a record player. I bought a new record player a couple of years ago because my last one blew up. And every now and then I will listen to the vinyl. And it is better. It's no doubt in my mind. It sounds better.
Yeah, it does.
What is it about Roy's stuff that really connects with you? What is it that makes it work for you?
Well, it's a really difficult question to answer, but I'll try. And he has a sort of intensity about him that, you know, either is live or on the record, that really fascinates me. And I really like his voice and what he does with his voice. You know, is really innovative. What would you call it? Is really creative with his. If we're talking about a live setting, he's really fantastic, and what he does with the guitar and the voice together is, you know, it really fills the room, doesn't it?
And it really does.
And sometimes, you know, when you listen to him, if you listen to Born in Captivity or something like that, and you know, after listening for 10 minutes, you realize that it's just him and the guitar, and you don't really miss the drums or the bass or whatever. It's just a complete, the sound is just very complete. And that's just him with the guitar, and that's fascinating. You know, as a poet, you know, or as a lyricist, he's really great. Although some of it is a bit of a mystery to me every once in a while, I have to admit.
Well, a lot of it still is to many people. The impression I've got, it's the whole package. It's the sort of sonic quality of what he does. And it's I think what you said about his voice as well. I mean, part of that is just the way he throws himself into the songs.
Yeah, and it really does.
You can tell when a singer is just treading the boards and earning the money and not really caring about what they're doing. And you can tell when somebody is utterly devoted to the songs that they're singing and the performance that they're doing. And I think, you know, Roy fits into that latter category, and people like you and people like me respond to that really well.
Yes.
However, it drive other people away, because it's a bit uncompromising, if that makes any sense.
Yes. Yeah, you could be, you know.
I mean,
that's a valid point, I think.
Do you know many other Harper fans in Norway? That's the obvious next question.
No, I don't. I have a couple of friends that really picked up on him in the same way that I did. But I find it difficult to convert people. And I think you talked about this on a podcast the other day. Some guy, one of the podcasts, that this was an issue. And I really agree. And it has to do with... either I'm selling it too hard and people, you know, back off because of that. That could be a reason, because I, you know, get excited and I try to play different songs and it could be a bit much for them. I don't know. That might be a main reason. Might be one of the reasons. And I can't really think of any other, because, you know, it's marvelous. It's great. But, you know, it's very difficult to sell.
It is. It really is. My wife's been to a few gigs with me now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think she's just about got used to it. But, yeah, it's just one of those things. You either love it or you hate it. There doesn't seem to be a middle ground, you know. And I find that really interesting. So you said you went to a gig in Oslo. Mm-hmm. What other gigs have you managed to get to?
A couple of years after that, in 1990, I saw him. He was doing a New Year's thing in at the 100 Club. So I went to that. It was
He did those for quite a while, yeah.
Yeah, two nights in a row, and that was fantastic. And that was also when I sauntered up to the mixing desk and was standing there with my Bullet in the Mingways album, the LP, and, you know, and Jackie was behind the mixing desk, and I had, you know, I was really weighing it, whether I should do it or not, going up there and ask, you know, to, if she could get me an autographed, get me the album autographed. But that, you know, I finally did it, and she must have taken pity on me, standing there with the album in my hand, and just, you know, God, we looked a little pathetic, probably, but she was really sweet, really kind, and took it backstage and getting it signed and everything. That was great.
It's always very nerve-wracking when you meet somebody like that for the first time and you don't know quite what they're going to be like, you know.
I've
had the same thing with people.
I think she got the picture pretty quickly when she first looked saw me. I think. Oh.
So you're obviously a bit of a vinyl collector. Have you bought the CDs as well?
Yes. Well, some of them, at least. I bought the HQ album and also the Juggler album, the Unknown Soldier, and well, that's about it, I think. The ones I got directly on CD. Sadly, I didn't. I don't know if that even was issued on vinyl. Was it? Do you know?
I believe it was, but I haven't got a copy of it on vinyl, I don't think.
No.
Oh, actually, maybe I have. I'm not sure. I'll have to look in my box now. I think it did come out on vinyl, but I don't think there was too much of it around. I think at that point, you know, they were winding it down quite a lot.
I did one thing that that I'm really happy about now, and I found that the other night. When I bought the Descendants of Smith album on vinyl, I actually bought two. And I had one of them sealed at the shop, never opened, with the receipt in a plastic cover. And I found that yesterday.
Yeah, I was going to say about vinyl, as you will have picked up, one of my other enthusiasms is Van de Graaff Generator, who've got a new album out in March. Mm-hmm. And they're doing a vinyl pressing as well as a CD pressing. And they're pressing 1,000 vinyl albums. And I'm on a Peter Hamill mailing list, and lots of people were saying, oh, why are they doing that? Nobody will buy the vinyl, you know. They'll never sell 1,000. They'd be lucky to sell 100. And then this guy chipped in who owns a record shop and said, you know, we actually sell as much vinyl as we do CDs now. And and most of the vinyl is going to people in their sort of, you know, late teens or 20s. And I found that really interesting.
Yeah, I have a... some of the guys that I play with in the band are about 10 or 15 years younger than me now, and they're also into vinyl. So it's and that's very interesting to see how that's going to go. You know, if the vinyl is going to stay, or, you know, to be getting, you know, getting their strength back or whatever, and getting to be, you know, to keep going. That's going to be interesting to see.
Mm.
I hope so.
Yeah, so do I, actually. I mean, I haven't bought vinyl for a few years, I have to admit. I have succumbed a bit to the download stuff as well, but that's mainly because I work at a computer all day and it's just easy, but the sound suffers because of that.
Well, you know, if you judge by the one store in Oslo that's been, you know, the biggest one that, you know, has vinyl as their main... you know, they're selling vinyl. That's about it. And if you see the development for just about 2 years back, their stock is now tripled. They had to move to a different location because they needed, you know, more space. So it's clearly picking up.
Perhaps I can jump to my usual future of music question early then, since we're talking about vinyl, CDs, and downloads.
Yeah.
I still don't really know what's happening with commercial music, but there was a quote from, I think it was Keith Richard a couple of weeks ago, who said that the normal situation for musicians is they have no money. and then there was this strange freak period, 60s, 70s, 80s, whatever, where performing artists could make amazing amounts of money through selling records. And he says, well, that seems to have gone away again now, and we're back to the old situation where you can make some money from performing, but you don't make anything from a recording. What do you think about that? You said you were in a band. I mean, what's your view on whether people can actually make a living from music?
Well, I don't know really. From my point of view, I've never made any money of it, but I'm also not a professional musician, so obviously, I think that we might be in a period that's going to, you know, in a middle phase where as you said, the downloading business and everything needs more time to be consolidated or to, you know, put into proper forms and so forth, because obviously it's not when you put out an album, it's not going to be the same kind of costs involved in terms of printing or pressing or whatever. It's going to be downloads and also the price is going to be stabilized put into context and getting the pricing right and everything, but when you reach that level, it's probably going to be more of a situation where the artists get their fair share of it again, don't you think? But now this is a kind of a middle period because they're still selling the CDs. And
do you think that creativity is being held back because of the way things are at the moment? If you were Roy Harper now, a younger version of Roy Harper, do you think you'd still have the same opportunity to break through and reach an audience?
In some ways, it could be easier, or not easier, but you know, more possibilities because of the internet, MySpace. It could be. I don't know. I haven't really, but I would think that there is a different kind of market out there now, and artists also have. Given more possibilities of promoting and selling their own stuff compared to the old days where you had to have a record label or a deal to get things done and promoted and so, but still it might be a little early as we were talking about. That could be a situation now where there's in between or a transition or whatever, because before it settles properly. But the internet is obviously given bands better ways to promote themselves and getting themselves out there. But still, you have to have the. I think it still involves luck. It still involves the old good old luck factor. I think is really important.
Yeah, I agree entirely with that, and you know. If somebody happens to find somebody's music and thinks it's great and then, you know, shares it with lots of other people, word of mouth spreads and they become popular. And the internet surely has made that kind of thing much easier to do. I don't know. I'm still trying to work out how it's going to go as well.
The problem with it is that even though it's easier to get out there, there still is a lot of competition. So it's basically down to maybe a combination of luck and having good material. If you have luck and good material, you have a fighting chance.
I think you're right. And I still think that a lot of gigging also helps. I mean, look at what Nick Harper's doing. He's always gigging. He's out and about on the road a lot. Yeah. And I'm sure that's helped him a lot as well.
You know? Of course.
Talking of gigging... now, I happen to know that you and I will hopefully meet in person later this year, because you are coming to the Metropolis gig, which I'll have spoken about in the intro to this podcast at great length.
Yeah.
And I'm
looking forward to that.
About it.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Yeah. Now, do you think it's outrageously expensive?
No.
There's a leading question.
No, I don't. Absolutely not. You know, go to a concert today, you know, what do you pay? You pay about easily £100, don't you, for a concert? At least you do in Norway.
Well,
for a proper concert, for a proper gig, for a proper artist.
It depends on the situation. Yeah, if it's a big artist and a big production, then yes, it will cost that sort. If, on the other hand, you're going to see one man and a guitar in the back room of a pub, it's going to be a tenner.
Yeah, £10, so of course. So, but, you know, don't forget the champagne, Paul. Don't forget the champagne.
I won't forget the champagne.
And the DVD.
Full advantage of that.
Drink with both hands. No, I don't think it's I don't think it's expensive. You know, I gladly pay that to get to an event like this, because it's also, you know, one, what is it, 125 people, is it, in the audience?
Yeah, something like that.
Mm.
Yeah. I was kind of joking when I asked you the question, because I knew what your answer would be.
Oh, you've been the leading question.
Had some... Yeah. we've had some long-time ARPA fans basically saying, oh, how can he do that? He should still be back in a basement club somewhere charging, you know, 10 shillings for a gig. You know, and I understand that point of view, but, you know... Roy needs his retirement fund, let's face it, and he's, you know, it's a big undertaking, and I nothing would have stopped me from going, and I think a lot of people that will be there will feel that way as well, and I think there'll be a pretty special atmosphere, and you know, I don't think you can begrudge the man a fairly big chunk of cash for a unique event.
I couldn't believe my luck when I actually got the tickets and were able to buy them, because I was sure it's going to be sold out quickly, or quicker than that I was, you know, after, you know, discovering it on the net. But obviously, I was successful. I persevered.
Well, I think there's a few people coming from outside the UK, from what I've seen. So I think it's going to have a really good feel to it, and I'm. For fear of repeating myself from previous podcasts, the solo Roy gig that we had at the Jazz Cafe last year, I enjoyed so much, and I thought, you know, if that's the last time I ever see him, that's good enough for me. But this is, you know, hopefully this is going to be as good, and if it is, then we'll all be happy.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about your music a bit. You've alluded to the fact that you're in a band. What do you do in the band, and what sort of music is it?
Well, it's the covers that we do varies from you know, standards like some Pink Floyd, some REM, some Neil Young, and some newer stuff like newer bands like Monster Magnet, stuff like that, and we also you know, do some of our own stuff, and that's fun. That's fun to do. And I know I'm in my early 40s now, so you know, I'm calmed down a little bit. But I love playing. It's I love playing. It's fantastic. It's great. And to be able to experience
how often
that.
Do you gig?
Well, we don't. Well, we gig for beer. So you know, free beer, and you know, and we're there. But you know, as when we were actually we're on a break now, but. Well, 5 or 6 times a year, something like that, at parties, or if someone asks, we will be happy to do it. But we're not really professional. We never got it out. No, we never did get out of the garage. So, but it still is fun.
And you're a guitarist, right?
Yeah, I am. I started playing when I was around 18 years old, something like that. And the general consensus at that time at school was that, why are you starting now? It's way too late. And thinking of it now, it's, you know, funny. But that was the consensus, you know. Why are you starting now, man? It's way too late.
I mentioned to you in an email earlier that my son William's just started guitar. He's 13 years old now.
That's not too late. That's not too late.
And he got interested. Well, he's got interested in music lately. I bought him an iPod last year for his birthday, and the whole musical journey has kicked off. And I am really, really enjoying seeing him discover music and find out what he likes. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, he still thinks my musical taste is really good, although obviously that will change as he suddenly
strikes out on his own.
Stuff, yeah. At the moment, he's really into Porcupine Tree, which is one of my progressive bands that I like. But he started, he knew that I could play guitar a bit, and you know, was interested in it. So I gave him a little demo of my acoustic and let him have a go. So he got a cheap electric guitar actually for Christmas, one of those cheap Fender sort of starter guitars with a little amp and so on. So, you know, I'm trying to show him a few things, and he's got some books. He's not having proper lessons or anything, not at this stage anyway, but I thought it would be quite fun because I'll get him to listen to this podcast. So perhaps you could say, for your first sort of month of as a guitar player, what would be the best way of picking it up? What do you reckon?
Well, it depends a little because is he interested in learning to read music and so on also?
Well, he plays the flute already and he can read music.
Okay. Because I can't. Absolutely. Uh-huh. I'm just not able to read any music. I just pick it up and play. And that was also the starting point for me when I started. I just went for it in a kind of a Neil Youngish way, I think. I think the main thing is not to be discouraged and just keep at it, I think. And you reach a certain point where it just gets easier. I clearly remember getting past the bar chord barrier or the bar record when you use your index finger and press down on the strings. I clearly remember passing that. And suddenly that was easy in the very beginning. And no, you have these, I think you have these stages that you go through. And but I was really lucky when I started out because we got straight into a band. I was going to law school at that point, and I had a friend of mine that at that point had played quite a lot of guitar, but he was, I think he gave up because he had a friend of his that started playing a couple of years after him and just surpassed him very quickly. So he got rid of his guitar and started playing bass instead. And then we hooked up and started playing. And I think that he was really encouraged. He really encouraged me to try and not to hold back. And that I think crammed about 10 years of experience into something like 2 or 3 years. Because I tried anything, and that really is a really good way to learn quickly, to just not hold back, not feel shy, just go for it, whether it's soloing or something.
I mean, I started as a piano player as a kid. I had piano lessons and took exams in piano, but it's very sort of structured, and then at school and at sixth form college, again, like you, I met up with like-minded musical people. And actually, I started playing the bass, bizarrely enough, because there were already two guitarists and we just wanted to fill out the sound a bit. And I thought, the bass looks easy. I'll do that. But then when I moved on and went to university, I thought, I'll try a bit of acoustic guitar as well, and found that was better. And I can play that on my own and noodle away for hours with it, and that's the fun of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of acoustic guitars, I really like the sound that Roy Harper managed to do with his Ovation guitars. He quit playing the Ovations in the late 80s, early 90s, didn't he? I think I saw him in Oslo in 91 or 92, and I think he was playing Gibsons at that point, wasn't he?
Right. Was it Gibsons he moved on to? I can't remember. But he played Ovations for quite a while. But it's interesting that you like it, because there's a lot of people that really hate the sound of them as well. It tends to divide people. But I think he managed to do an awful lot with it on stage with effects and stuff as well,
Yeah, I think the sound of the Ovation became, to me anyway, it seems to me like an important part of his sound at one point, at least during the 80s. And I can't play them myself because of the rounded the guitar, the back of them. It's difficult. I think they're difficult to hold, but the sound of them, I think it was. That's some a really classic sound that I connect to Roy.
I've got an Applause, which is a cheapo version of
same here.
But it has the same round back. It's got a bright blue front. I like it, but I don't play it so much now. You're right, though. It is quite hard to... I haven't thought about it before. That rounded back actually does get in the way. Yeah.
I have an applause also, but it sits in his cupboard. It's not... sits in the cupboard. It hasn't been played all that much. But also, I think it's a very big difference playing acoustic compared to the electric. Every time I suspect that I might be in the vicinity of an acoustic guitar, and there is a real danger of me being asked to play something, I practice a couple of hours beforehand, if I can. That's it's not that easy, to go back to the acoustic when you play the electric.
That's an interesting point, because again, talking about my son, I said to him, you know, if you're really serious about it, you should try it. You should pick up the acoustic first, because it's harder.
I agree.
And of course, he immediately said, I'm having electric, you know.
I totally agree. He's going to feel like a total rock star after a month on the acoustic when he switches to the electric.
Okay, that was a nice little guitar intermission there. Going back to music again, one of the other things, and especially talking about the future of the music industry and how we find out about other artists, I'm always really, really interested to hear what other stuff people listen to. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I'd ask you, I mean, you've obviously got quite a diverse taste in music, but is there anything in particular you really like that you think that the discerning Roy Harper fan might also be interested in listening to?
I'm drawing a blank on that at the moment because... I'm drawing a blank on that one at the moment. I can't really think of anything. Yeah. You seem in the same category or in the same... or is it?
No, not really. I mean, the thing is, a Harper fan can come from many different directions. There'll be folk music fans, which there are many. There'll be, you know, rock fans that come in through Floyd and Zeppelin. There'll be progressive fans because, although some people argue with this, some of Roy's music is defined by some people as a kind of progressive folk almost. Mm. So it's a very wide discipline, I suppose. And as a result, if you talk to any Roy Harper fan about what they're into, you'll get very different answers. So it doesn't have to be anything similar. I'm interested to know what your kind of top three bands are, if you like.
My top three bands? Oh. It's the old classics, basically. I haven't been all that good at, you know, keeping up with the new things, so... but you know, Pink Floyd obviously is definitely one of my three top bands. Harper is, and I also really like REM a lot, especially the older stuff, not the later stuff, because the later stuff tends to be more girl stuff. You know, it appeals more to girls than it does to not. That's not necessarily a bad thing though. But if you go back to R.E.M. before 1990, that's really interesting stuff. The college stuff, the guitar-based, really bare-bones rock and roll R.E.M. That's really...
that's interesting.
I really like that because it's so simple and and you really have to work at, you know, work... You really have to listen to it a number of times before you get get to like it, or you know, before it settles. But that's also the kind of music that goes with you, doesn't it, over the years, that you can go back to and still enjoy.
I agree entirely.
That's
definitely the case.
An example there, I would say that Pink Floyd's Animals, which is maybe the most difficult to get a hold of, or get to know, is also the album that gives me the most now to listen to.
How does that match with Dark Side of the Moon? Have you listened to that too much now?
Yeah, well, not necessarily, because I can go back to that and also find different things, because that's also a very layered album, I think. And if you listen to it on different stereos or different formats, different things can suddenly pop out that you haven't noticed all that before. Like I clearly remember when the remaster version of The Dark Side, I think it was in connection with the 30th anniversary or something like that, and I put it on, and suddenly I noticed the drums on Breathe. I think it was the riding or the the riding in the drumming on Breathe was suddenly more clearer.
Right.
So you have these different details that when you know the music so well, suddenly there are different details that can pop up that you hadn't really noticed before. And I think that Dark Side is a really layered album in that respect, and also Animals is. There's some great soloing on Animals. Absolutely.
Have you listened to the quadraphonic mix of Dark Side of the Moon?
No, I haven't. Is it good?
You can get it. It's not. I don't think it's an official release, but or maybe it's semi-official. But you can get a kind of DTS surround sound disc of it now that you can play on your home cinema. It's quite fun actually, and it is mixed very differently because I think Alan Parsons did the mix. It was either for a demo or they were going to do a quadraphonic release or something. Yeah, that's worth seeking out from what you were talking about, the textured audio and finding new stuff from the audio from something that you're so familiar with. I found that quite revelatory. I was busy working at my desk, and I have a surround speakers around my computer, and I stuck it on. And it's one of those when you completely stop working, you stop thinking about what you're doing, and you just sit there and listen. And, 40 minutes later, I thought, that was good, And it's so nice when that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. That's nice.
Okay. Well, we're kind of getting towards the end. What we haven't spoken about from Roy's stuff is there anything of Roy's that you really don't care for very much, that doesn't strike the right kind of chord?
No, not really. But I would much more prefer to point out some of the things that I like the best in that respect. And that would be just now before we hooked up, I was listening to the Descendants of Smith album again, and I think that's a really nice album, for instance. And probably also quite underrated. And I really love The Unknown Soldier, of course. The Unknown Soldier, that's also because of the Gilmore connection, seeing that he has, I think he is credited with the co-written five songs, I think, on The Unknown Soldier. And especially the solo at the end of Flycatcher is a fantastic piece of work. Really like that. And especially the ending there, you can see that this was in 1980, and I think that I read somewhere that when they did the final cut, the Pink Floyd album, they would just, took the amplifiers out of storage and just brought them to the studio. And there was very little tweaking on the high watts. It was, they plugged it in and it sounded great. But the Unknown Soldier must have been in between the recording of The Wall and the final cut. So it's very The Wall-ish. This guitar is very... very similar to The Wall, I would say, and that's nice. That's great, and the songs are great, really great. Of course, you have the HQ album, which I also love. That's also a marvelous album. So I tend to go for the Roy Harper as a rocker, I think.
Yeah, you do. I was just thinking that. That's interesting.
But I also. When it comes to the acoustic things, the Born in Captivity is also a stunning piece of work. It's a stunning piece of work.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what he actually plays at this Metropolis gig. Actually, thinking about, when you were just talking about the albums, I thought, there's so many of them. So much material. How on earth do you pick, two 45-minute sets, which is what I believe we're getting?
And we haven't even spoken about the Jimmy Page connection or all the songs, in connection with that.
Oh, no. Yeah.
there's a there's a lot.
Well, it is. I mean, in the olden days, he says, sounding very old, when Rory used to play like four nights at the Half Moon Putney or whatever, we'd have a different set every night. And, you know, it must be a blessing and a curse for an artist to have such a large body of work, because they've got a lot of stuff they can draw on and they can really, you know, mix it up. But on the other hand, you have to remember all those lyrics.
That's one thing. Songs. And, you know, all this has to be rehearsed before going on stage, I would suspect. And that, you know, playing three or four different sets in a row, that would be... that would entail quite a lot of rehearsing beforehand, I would think.
Mm, yeah, I think so. Pretty tough thing. I have seen him rehearse a couple of times. When I went over there to do the interview with him, he had a bit of a practice. I think Matt Churchill popped over and they were practicing some stuff as well. And I know, you know, well, you as a musician know this fully well as well. An awful lot of preparation work goes into these things. And, you know, if he's doing it just for one Metropolis gig, I reckon he should rehearse and then go on a tour for more gigs and make the most of the rehearsal. Maybe.
Do you know if Matt Churchill is also going to play at the Metropolis gig, or is it just
I don't, his own? But I don't. I suspect it's just him. Mm-hmm. I don't know for certain, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be just Roy. But as I say, the Jazz Cafe gig last year was just Roy, and it was blindingly good. Absolutely.
It's been quite a while since I saw him. Now I saw him in London again. Actually, also at the 100 Club, must have been 3 years or something like that. 3 years ago, maybe.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Two nights in a row. And that's the last time I've seen him since then.
We've probably been in the same room then.
I see. Okay.
I've been to a lot of those, although not all of them, but yeah. we're nearly at the end of my very vague list of things that I'd like to talk to you about. I think we've covered a fairly decent bit of ground there. But is there anything you want to talk about, Tobin?
Well, you know there is, Paul. I have a sentence I have to put in at the end here. It's about Led Zeppelin, and I think that Presence is the best Zeppelin album. Discuss.
Why is it the best Zeppelin album for you?
I think it's a really rock and roll album. It has real intensity, I think. And I know it's just rocks, and I also think at that point, you know, they were really getting into stride in terms of, at least that's what I think, in terms of playing, in terms of how they used the studio, and that was just in hindsight, after listening to all the albums now, all the Zeppelin albums for a number of years, this is the one that stands out for me. I don't know. It's just a fantastic album. Really underrated.
It drives along. I mean, Achilles' Last Stand is such a driving barrage of noise. It's a really, really strong track. And what's the last track called? I can't remember.
T for One, I think. That's the slow blues.
Yeah, I mean, that's got a real feel about it.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of, it has some emotional resonance in me somehow.
And then you have Royal Orleans, Nobody's Fault But Mine. No, it's a real rock and roll album. There's no organ on that one. It's all screaming guitars.
True, actually, that is what's missing. Yeah. So they've stepped back from you know, No Quarter and Kashmir with lots of instrumentation, and gone back to a much more sort of pared down approach. Interesting point.
But I do realize it's quite a controversial viewpoint. So that's why I said it. Get the discussion going.
Yeah, I'm all for that. Okay. I'm just, while we're talking, I'm trying to think of what I think their best album is. And I think I'd go for Physical Graffiti just because of the variance on there. And again, I think the playing is superlative.
Yeah, well, it's difficult to disagree.
Better to, yeah, they could have brought out two different albums, and not done a double album. But
So what Harper album do you think is the best then? You ever been asked that question?
It's got to be Stormcock. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's definitely Stormcock. Mm. I mean, yes, it's not a band album. But it's Roy at his most creative, and possibly his most self-indulgent as well, because he didn't hold back on complicated arrangements, very hard-hitting lyric constructs. I love Jimmy Page's contribution as well. The production is fantastic.
Yeah.
And the band in Me and My Woman is so, it adds such an emotional layer to that track as well. I think that's his perfect album personally. Yeah.
I have to go back and listening to it now. I haven't heard the remastered version, so that's really interesting too.
Okay. Well, the remaster is subtle. It's not, you know, it's not in your face completely gone mad, but that's good in a way, because a lot of remastering just tends to be louder, and this isn't really quite louder.
Yeah. No, I agree totally.
Yeah. Anything else?
Well, not that I can think of at the moment. It's been really nice to get the opportunity to do this. I've been a little bit nervous the last few days, you know, going through my Roy Harper collection and thinking a little bit.
Yeah.
But that's probably natural. Yeah, probably natural.
I've really enjoyed talking to you as well. Do send me some photos from the gig you went to, and we'll need a nice one of you as well for the show notes, if you've got a funny photo of you or whatever you want to send me, actually a photo of your cat if you like, or whatever.
That can probably be arranged.
Okay. And you know, thanks ever so much for talking to us. I found it really interesting, and I'm really looking forward to clinking my champagne glass with you.
Yeah, likewise, absolutely.
At the gig. Brilliant. So, Tobin, thank you ever so much.
Thank you. Good night.
Thanks very much, Tobin, and we'll have a Roy track to follow on from there. And since he said it was one of his favourites, we're going to have The Flycatcher from The Unknown Soldier.
I saw a fine lady ghost across the tops, with a ring on her finger and the winds on her toes. She can have music the cherry tree, the chestnut grove.
Now, listeners to the last podcast will know that my wife was busy doing a charity cycle ride in the early part of 2011 across Vietnam and into Cambodia. And I was going to be following this up with a nice 2-week holiday for me to relax and for her to recover. Just thought for those of you that did donate to the cause, and thank you very much, you know who you are. She did manage to do it. Well, she did about 90% of it. She had a bit of a heat stroke and had to be dipped in a nice bath to recover and put on the bus for a little while. And it's not surprising because it's a very tough environment. You can train for distance on the cycle, but you can't train for the intense heat and humidity, and that really took its toll. But I'm very proud of her. She's managed to raise above her target now for the charity, over a couple of £1,000. Really, really chuffed. Well done. Okay, we're nearly at the end. I'm afraid it's time for the legal bump. This podcast is issued under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 2.0 UK, England and Wales license. That means you can share it with others, but you can't change it, claim you made it, or charge money for it. The Roy Harper music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Science Friction Limited and is not for copying or redistribution. And the music by Adam Leonard is used by kind permission of Adam Leonard and is copyright to him. And please don't copy or redistribute that either. Okay, we don't have any listener feedback from last time as such, so I will give out the voicemail number, however, if you wish to call in and leave an audio message. It's particularly if you're going to next week's gig and want to give some thoughts and comments. It's 01223 850 282 in the UK, or if you're outside the UK, +44 1223 850 282. Or much better than that, if you've got the ability to record yourself speaking as an MP3, do that and then email me the file. pd@stormcot.net will reach me. I really like receiving those, so please do if you can. Now, I've deliberately not made any particular comment on all the insanity that's going on in the world since last time a podcast came out, what with natural disasters and man-made lunacy. All I can really do is say I'm going to finish this podcast with the live version of Burn the World. See you next time.
This is a song... This is a song called Burn the World. Now, this song was refused by EMI Records some time back on the grounds that it wasn't really that commercial. Well, Burning the World really won't be that commercial. So I got a friend in the north who... Wrong voice. As soon as he knew I'd written a song called Burn the World that was over 20 minutes long, he went, "It's a single then, isn't it?" So we figured out that, you know, it's just what Radio 1 needs is another 20-minute single. Yeah, what a mess. Thank you.
on the street, grabbing easy meat with furious claim. Somebody's killed, anger's spilled, vengeance is free. Robert's on the beat, looking nice and neat for a one-sided fight. In his uniform, looking to perform with the flashing blue light. He doesn't care, anything's fair, cause he's always right. As the flames of night burn equal right in the wind. Whispering, whispering. Whispering, why don't you know? Why don't you know? Burn the late, she's got no escape from Billy's brute force to winter cause in a frenzy rave. Both defiled by the crowded wilds, the time bomb of hate modernizes demise. And Robert dies in the same hail of lies that his master's device, a pretend surprise. And his fury cries, begin to rise. Whispering, whispering, whispering. Yeah. still, to a standstill, to a standstill, to a standstill. Is it better to laugh than to grieve when it doesn't matter whether I live, whether I am evermore, or whether I am anymore? A home. Yellow Sand and Blue Lagoon. Invite you all to come and live there one afternoon. It'll be when no one's looking, more likely than not. We'll close the door, turn the sky up, find a good spot.
whispering. Why don't you? Why don't you?
Drink change.